laughed if the situation wasn't so serious. He'd fucked her so hard that she fought down the urge to giggle helplessly. He'd made love like a man who'd just got out of prison. But that was exactly what he had done. Her eyes trailed over his body, unsure where to look. He was more muscular than she'd expected, for a ground pounder who'd been trapped in a cell for 5 years. It had been a long time for her, too. Abigail bit her lip, forcing herself to concentrate. She was an adult, old enough to have grown children of her own. And she was part of a group marriage that understood that, sometimes, a partner would want to go elsewhere for sex. None of her husbands and wives would blame her for having sex, although they might have quite a bit to say about the person she'd had sex with. Alan had murdered his wife. That alone would be enough to make him a pariah in the belt, if he wasn't executed on the spot. No one would blame his wife's family for killing him if the law refused to do the job. She looked down at herself. Her shipsuit trousers were around her ankles, crumpled on the deck. Her shirt was open, revealing her breasts. She was too much a belter to be embarrassed by casual nudity, too old a player to feel vulnerable. Hell, Alan was at least 5 years younger than her, perhaps more. His file hadn't been clear on that, either. Would he have a fit when he realized she was in her late 40s? Or would he care after spending so long in jail? Fuck, she said out loud. It had been quick, but good. She hadn't felt quite so much determination to lose herself in raw sensation since she'd become a married woman. And yet, she knew it would lead to complications. Belters wouldn't object to a quick tryst, but ground pounders took matters much more seriously. Alan was a physical adult. He had children, for crying out loud. But she knew he might not be emotionally mature. A man who could kill his wife in a fit of rage certainly wasn't that mature. It might be different for him, of course, Abigail reflected. He pledged himself to a single woman. Fuck, Alan echoed. Abigail sighed and reached for her trousers, pulling them up as quickly as she could. She'd have to shower, of course. She wondered, inanely, what she was supposed to do. She kicked herself mentally. There weren't many options on the ship if she'd wanted to find a partner for the night, but she could have just used a VR tape. Or even, she sighed. Alan had killed his wife. It wasn't something she was inclined to forgive. She buttoned up her shirt, resisting the urge to watch as Alan fixed his clothes. It felt better, somehow, to be covered. And yet it was not a pleasant sensation. Abigail, Alan said. Abigail did not want to have that talk. Not now. Get out, she said. He needed a shower too, but she wanted to be alone. She'd done something stupid. Now. Alan opened his mouth, then turned and opened the hatch. Abigail allowed herself a sigh of relief as he stepped through, the hatch hissing closed behind him. If they were lucky, no one would see him before he'd managed to shower and change. No one would say anything out loud, but there would be whispered rumors. God alone knew where they'd lead. Fuck, she thought once again. She checked the status display, then started to undo the ship suit. Her breasts were covered with faint marks, testament to their brief passion. She touched one of the bruises lightly and shook her head. Given how hard she'd squeezed his buttocks, she was fairly sure he was bruised too. His skin was lighter. It was quite possible someone would see the marks and jump to all sorts of conclusions. She wondered, with a flicker of grim amusement, just what they'd say. The two glasses stood on the table, mocking her. She eyed them for a long moment, then picked the glasses up and carried them into the washroom. She couldn't blame the alcohol any more than she could blame Alan himself. And yet she wanted to blame him. All of a sudden, she thought she understood how he felt. If he blamed his wife for cheating on him, if he considered that sufficient reason to kill her, he could avoid the guilt. The delusion kept him from having to face what he had done. He was inside me, she thought, as she turned on the shower and stepped into the water,
And I felt... what?
She snorted in annoyance. The hell of it was that she had enjoyed herself. It had been brief, but intense. She was certainly old enough to make her own decisions. And most of her crew were mature enough to understand that she had desires too. Anson and Poddy were the only ones who would be horrified at the thought of their aged mother having sex. Reaching for a sponge, she scrubbed herself down. It was hardly the first time she'd had a one-night stand, although she'd always been fairly sure she wouldn't have to see her partner again afterwards. But now, she wasn't sure how she felt. Alan had done things she couldn't forgive. And yet she'd been so desperate for human touch that she'd kissed him.
You are responsible for what you do,
she reminded herself sharply. Her parents and uncles had said the same thing when she'd been younger.
And you have to deal with the consequences.
She turned off the water and stepped out of the shower. She'd get dressed, then go to the bridge. They hadn't seen any sign of the enemy, but that didn't mean that the convoy was safe. She was all too aware that the aliens wouldn't need to strain their drives if they wanted to catch up with the fleeing freighters, assuming the aliens had a rough idea where to start looking. The convoy didn't even have a nominated CO to take command, if the aliens did show themselves. A military CO would probably have assumed overall command by now.
Perhaps we take our independence a little too far,
she thought, as she pulled on her underwear and reached for a fresh ship suit.
There's a war on now.
Tying her hair back, she studied herself in the mirror. She looked tired, but there was no visible sign she'd had sex. That was something, at least. No one would judge her for having a one-night stand when they were docked at an asteroid station, but they were in the middle of a war zone. Someone would probably insist she was neglecting her sworn duty. Perhaps she was. Her lips twitched into a humorless smile. If the aliens had shown up when they were fucking.
Don't delude yourself,
she told herself sharply. One of the reasons she let herself go, one she wouldn't acknowledge outside the privacy of her head, was the grim awareness that they could die at any time.
If the aliens show up, we're dead.
She took one last look in the mirror, then strode out of the cabin. She had work to do. And if Alan couldn't be professional about it...
Fuck him, she thought. And not literally, this time.
Alan felt... he wasn't sure how he felt. He forced himself to walk down the corridor, praying with a fervor he hadn't felt in years that no one noticed him until he was safely in the cabin. He hadn't prayed like that since the time his best friend had brought illicit cigarettes into school, even though he had known the headmaster was on the warpath. Being caught would mean real trouble. He might even have been expelled, although it hadn't been his idea. Alan's father wouldn't have taken that lightly. God knew he'd been furious when Alan really had been transferred to a borstal. The hatch opened as soon as he keyed the switch. Bennett was lying on his bed, reading a datapad. Alan cringed inwardly. Some men would slap him on the back and congratulate him for scoring, but he doubted Bennett would do anything of the sort. He was Alan's watchdog, not his friend or comrade. And Alan was ruefully aware that the truth was written all over his face. He probably smelled of sex. He pushed that thought out of his head as hard as he could, then headed straight into the shower. Bennett didn't say a word, although Alan could feel Bennett's gaze burning into his back. The younger man was a soldier, after all. He was no stranger to finding female companionship for the night, then walking away in the morning. If half the stories about squaddies on leave were true, they made starfighter pilots look positively genteel.
All those stories about prison weren't true either,
he reminded himself as he stripped off his shipsuit.
Colchester wasn't bad.
Alan turned on the water, scrubbing himself down as quickly as he could. Water might not be rationed any longer, but he was still meant to set a good example. Besides, if the aliens jumped them, he'd have to run to his starfighter. There was no point manning the CIC when an extra starfighter might make the difference between survival and death. He sighed, shaking his head in dismay. There was a good chance that an extra starfighter would only mean one more craft blasted out of space during the battle. Shit, he thought. He wasn't entirely sure what had happened. No, he knew what had happened, but he didn't know why. He wasn't even sure which of them had made the first move. God knew that hadn't happened before, even when he'd lost his virginity. It was funny to remember, now, the handful of times he'd managed to sneak out of the borstal with the other lads and go drinking and skirt-chasing in the nearest town. In hindsight, he wondered if they'd been winked at by the teachers. God knew the police could have rounded them up if they'd caused real trouble. He had no idea what would have happened then. Teenage delinquents were normally sent to the borstals, but he doubted it would have been pleasant. Perhaps they would have been treated as adults and marched off to jail. Good thing we weren't officially caught, he told himself. I might never have had a chance to go to the stars. He groaned as he dragged his thoughts back to the present. His mind was a whirlwind of complicated emotions, blurring together so rapidly that he couldn't get a grip on them. He wanted to go back to her cabin and have sex with her again. He wanted to run as far from her as he could. He wasn't sure what he wanted. He'd been faithful to Judith while they'd been married, then involuntarily celibate during his incarceration. He cursed himself savagely for thinking with his smaller head. This was going to make his life harder. Shutting off the water, he toweled himself down. He and Abigail had had a complicated relationship even before the battle. She'd gotten him drunk and tricked him into telling her the truth. He shook his head in amused disbelief. Abigail was not like any other woman he'd met, for sure. But then, if half the tales about the asteroid settlements were true, she was only a little eccentric. He reminded himself sharply not to take the stories too seriously. It wasn't as if the stories about prison had been accurate either.
That's because you watched too many chicks in prison movies when you were younger, he reprimanded himself. And, like most pornographic shite, it bears as much resemblance to reality as a government white paper.
He stepped out of the washroom completely naked. Naval service, and then prison, had erased what little modesty he'd felt once upon a time. God knew the borstal hadn't encouraged modesty either. Had there actually been a time in his life when he'd enjoyed true privacy? He couldn't think of one after his transfer to the borstal. Privacy was a privilege, the headmaster had said, not a right. And it wasn't one extended to teenage boys who'd exhausted society's goodwill. Bennett looked up.
I hope it wasn't Maddie.
Alan felt himself flush.
No, he said stiffly. It wasn't.
Good,
Bennett said. He sounded strikingly disinterested.
Are you going to tell me all about it? Or do I have to drag the truth out of you?
Alan glared at him.
How old do you think I am? Your file says you're 41, Bennett said. Personally, I would have put you at 10 or 11.
I'm too old to engage in locker room talk, Alan said curtly.
He felt a hot flush of shame as he remembered just what he had said and heard in the changing rooms. They'd talked about girls, bragging of sexual exploits that were probably physically impossible, and in any case, certainly hadn't happened. He'd told his friends that he'd lost his virginity a long time before he'd even kissed a girl. They probably hadn't believed him, but then, he hadn't believed them either. It had all been part and parcel of growing up.
Glad to hear it, Bennett said. I trust that you and the captain will be professional at all times.
Alan jumped. How had he known? He realized his mistake an instant later. Bennett hadn't known, although he might have guessed the way Abigail had hauled Alan out of the hold. But it didn't matter. Bennett had probed lightly, and Alan's reaction had told him everything he needed to know. The amused look on his face, a smirk that made Alan want to punch him, only confirmed it. Bennett knew.
We can be professional, Alan said crossly.
I don't think...
I had noticed, Bennett said.
His voice was very dry.
That's a very strange woman, that one. And also one who isn't likely to let you get away with anything.
He sat upright, nearly cracking his head on the upper bunk.
I don't give much of a shit about what you do on your time off. As long as you do your duty, he added. You can always be returned to your cell if you fuck up. But I suggest that you keep it completely professional while you're on duty. This isn't a naval crew. If it was a naval crew, Alan pointed out, I'd be in real trouble. Quite, Bennett agreed. And so would she.
Alan nodded as he opened the compartment and retrieved a ship suit. Regulations were clear and backed up by a great deal of precedent. Senior officers were not allowed to have sexual relationships with their subordinates. The senior officer would be lucky if he, or she in some cases, was allowed to retire rather than being dishonorably discharged, while their junior would be on very thin ice. Haddock didn't have a naval crew, which was all that might save Abigail and himself if the truth ever came out. She hadn't had the regulations drilled into her from the moment she wore a cadet uniform.
Be careful, Bennett said. You're expendable. Right now, we're all expendable, Alan pointed out.
He pulled the ship suit over his head, then started to tighten the fastenings.
This whole ship is expendable. You're expendable. I know, Bennett said.
He didn't sound bothered, but Alan was sure he must be. Bennett was not a stupid man. He'd know just what the destruction of so many fleet carriers meant. Even if the Royal Navy managed to devise a counter to the alien weapons, they'd already taken heavy losses. And there was no way the other human nations could make up the shortfalls. They had problems of their own.
Be careful, Bennett said.
He smiled suddenly.
You do realize that Anson has been courting Maddie?
Alan blinked, surprised.
But you implied...
He shook his head.
Should we be worried? Perhaps we should be more worried about him, Bennett said.
He shrugged.
You killed in a fit of rage. Rage aimed at a very specific target. Maddie cold-bloodedly set out to defraud the Navy of a great deal of money.
Alan sighed. It was hard to believe that the young woman he knew was a cold-blooded fraudster. Maddie looked so young that he was tempted to wonder if she had joined the Navy at 16, rather than waiting until she was 18. It was rare, but it did happen. She made him feel protective, even though...
Right now, it isn't a problem, he said.
Maddie was old enough to make certain decisions for herself. She could handle the consequences, too. Besides, there was nothing on Haddock worth stealing.
And we have a great many other things to worry about.
Sure,
Bennett agreed. He stood and walked towards the hatch.
Your relationship with the captain, for one.
And he laughed. Chapter 19.
Ready to jump, Captain,
Anson said. Abigail allowed herself a moment of relief, mingled with fear. 5 weeks of making their way down the tram lines had left them jumping at every sensor contact, even after they'd entered a populated star system and exchanged notes with the defenders. Word was spreading, but she still had no idea what was waiting for them on the far side. Earth might have been smashed flat by now. The only real consolation was that Earth, according to a freighter they'd encountered, hadn't been attacked a week ago.
Which doesn't mean the system wasn't attacked yesterday, she thought grimly. This tramline network attracts less attention than the others.
Jump, she ordered quietly. She glanced down at the display as it blanked, then rebooted. Cold logic told her that they were in no danger of being intercepted, but she didn't find it very reassuring. She would almost have welcomed another fight, or fuck, with Alan, if only to keep her from brooding on what they'd find when they got home. Her nerves kept insisting that the aliens were lurking on the far side, ready to blow them away within spitting distance of Earth.
"Transit complete, Captain," Anson said. "Local space appears clear,"
Poddy said.
"I'm picking up transmissions from Earth now."
"Which may well be meaningless,"
Abigail thought. The makeshift analysts hadn't been able to figure out a way to defeat the alien stealth systems. She hoped the boffins back home would do better, or it would be a very short war.
But at least Earth wasn't attacked a few hours ago.
"Send our IFF," she ordered grimly, "and then take us back to Taliman."
She leaned back in her chair as the convoy started to crawl towards the asteroid base. Sol looked more industrialized than ever, power signatures glowing all over the system. And yet a number of familiar ports had gone dark. She hoped that was a good sign, perhaps one that suggested the inhabitants were trying to hide. If word had already reached Earth, the Belters would either be hiding or planning their exodus. She knew her own people too well to expect them to gamble everything on a desperate last stand. Alan's face appeared in the display.
"Captain," he said.
His voice was coolly professional, just as it had been for the last 5 weeks.
"Long-range sensors suggest that the system has not been attacked."
"So it would seem,"
Abigail agreed, equally professionally. At least he wasn't sulking. She hated men who sulked.
"It'll be a while before we get a response from Taliman."
"They should have received word already," Alan said. "And they may be suspicious of our safe return."
Abigail nodded slowly. The defenders might assume that her ship and the remainder of the convoy was nothing more than a Trojan horse. She didn't think the aliens would need to bother, but ground pounders were rarely logical. It was hard to blame them, for once. Losing so many fleet carriers so quickly had to have shocked them. They might even have stopped running in circles, screaming and shouting.
"Or maybe they'll be so panicky, they'll fire on us," she thought. "That would be bad." "We won't go too close to the base until we get a reply," she said.
They'd need hours to reach their destination, whatever happened.
"And they'll probably insist on searching the ship."
"Probably," Alan agreed. "I'd better get on with writing the report. The Navy will want to see it as soon as they know who we are."
Abigail resisted the urge to point out that he'd had 5 weeks to finish writing the report. He had written a very basic summary, which they'd forwarded to every starship, colony, and orbital installation they'd encountered. But the Navy senior officers would probably want something a little more comprehensive. She had read some of Alan's speculations, and had been left wondering why he hadn't been snapped up by the analysis department long ago. He was good at figuring out ways to minimize the alien advantages.
"At least on paper," she reminded herself. "It might not work so well in the real world." "Good luck,"
she said. She'd written a report of her own for the Belt Federation, although she wasn't sure if the Royal Navy would allow her to send it. Perhaps she should just fire it off before the Navy had a chance to object. It was easier to beg forgiveness than permission, after all.
"Let me know when you're ready."
She sat back in her chair and reached for her datapad. The final report was already complete, so she uploaded it to the message queue for later transmission. They'd send it directly to the Belt as soon as they were within range. She reread the report, then skimmed through a couple of others. Her eyebrows lifted in surprise as she noted the author. For someone who looked like a thug, Bennett was a surprisingly decent writer.
"Captain,"
Poddy said,
"we just picked up a message. They want us to head straight for Taliman, where we will receive new orders."
"Understood," Abigail said. "Anson, maintain current course."
"Aye, Captain."
Abigail frowned as she glanced at the timer. That was quick. Taliman had responded almost as soon as they'd received the first message. Unless it had been sent by a ship or installation closer to the tramline. She glanced at the header, but there was nothing to suggest who had sent it. It wasn't really a problem anyway. They certainly hadn't been ordered to maintain radio silence.
See if you can pick up any news broadcasts, she ordered after a moment. And inform me if they know what happened at New Russia. Aye, Captain,
Proddy said. She worked her console for a long moment.
I'm not picking up any news broadcasts, but I'd expect more panic.
True,
Abigail agreed. More and more icons had flashed to life on the display, but it didn't look as though the system was panicking. She ran through the possibilities in her head, time and time again. Someone should have brought word of the defeat to Earth by now. A warship or scout could have reached the homeworld before the convoy had left Kiev.
There should be something.
Maddie says the government doesn't tell the people everything, Anson said.
They might not have told the public about the battle.
Abigail scowled. Maddie was pretty, but she was a ground pounder who'd been in jail. Hardly the sort of girl she wanted her son to court. And yet she knew her son, and men in general, well enough to know that opposing the match would only drive the young lovers deeper into each other's arms. Besides, she was in no position to complain too much. She'd done enough stupid things when she'd been his age to fill a book.
Perhaps they didn't, she said.
It didn't sound likely, but it was precisely the sort of thing a ground pounder government would do. The Belt didn't know either then. They'd have spread the story right across the system if they knew.
But that's their problem.
She brought up the next report and frowned.
Time to Talliman?
4 hours at current rate, Anson said.
If we boost the drive, we leave the freighters behind. No, we'll stay with them,
Abigail said.
There's no hurry, after all.
Unless they really don't know what happened, she thought grimly. But the odds of that are... what?
She sighed. She didn't want to know. Alan wasn't too surprised when, as Haddock approached Talliman, they were greeted by the Royal Marines. Everyone on the ship was rounded up and held in the hold, while the Marines searched the ship from top to bottom, then tested everyone's DNA records before they relaxed. He didn't really blame them for being paranoid, even though he suspected that someone had watched too many movies about alien infiltrators. The search was an unsubtle indication that Earth knew what had happened at New Russia.
Someone got through, he thought grimly. And Earth is doing what?
The ship will hold position here for the moment, Captain Yates said,
once the majority of the crew had been told to go back to their duties or cabins. The Royal Marine was burly enough to give Bennett a run for his money.
You and Officer Bennett will accompany us to the base.
Understood,
Alan said. He knew he wasn't being given a choice.
I'll just inform the captain, then I'll be on my way.
He felt an odd pang of bitter regret as he keyed his wristcom, updating Abigail on his movements. Abigail had been coolly professional, so emotionally detached that he was tempted to wonder if it had all been a dream. They hadn't spoken in private since the night they'd fucked. He regretted that in some ways, even as he found it a relief in others. The sight of Anson and Maddie being together really didn't help. They seemed to have all the traits of young love.
Which might not survive the return to Earth, he thought, as he followed the Royal Marines onto their shuttle. There are other girls and boys here now.
Talliman Base had grown over the last month, he noted. There were 9 other freighters in the docking slips, in various stages of conversion. The makeshift escort carrier had clearly proved its value, he determined. He didn't want to think about any of the alternatives. A fleet carrier took nearly 16 months to build, starting from scratch. He puzzled over just how many corners could be cut without risking the ship, then gave it up as a bad job. The Navy's engineers would already be struggling to solve that problem.
But new fleet carriers would be sitting ducks, he thought,
as the shuttle docked.
We really need something new.
There was an air of desperation in the base as they were escorted through the corridors and into a small briefing compartment. Hundreds of men and women, most clearly reservists, were hurrying from place to place, their faces pale and wan. They knew all right. The civilians might not know, yet. But the military knew.
A month ago, humanity had been confident that the mass power of its space navies was hard to beat.
Now, we all got smashed, he told himself. Us, the Americans, the Russians, the French.
Commander Campbell, a voice said. Two men were sitting at the table, wearing unmarked uniforms.
Spooks, probably. He doubted they were his parole officers.
Take a seat.
Alan sat, bracing himself. Bennett stood behind him. Perhaps it was a parole meeting after all. The bean counters wouldn't let a little thing like catastrophic defeat and the death of thousands of personnel get in their way if they had procedures to follow. They hadn't bothered to tell him about any conditions that might be attached to his parole, but that didn't mean they didn't exist.
We received word from New Russia 2 weeks ago, the first man said. His name tag read Tagger. Your records have filled in some of the gaps, thankfully.
Alan nodded, concealing his relief.
He had feared that they would be the first to bring word from New Russia. Humanity would have lost more time while the aliens gathered their forces and drove on Earth. His worst nightmares, at least, had not come to pass.
We also read your report with considerable interest, Tagger added. Why do you believe the alien stealth systems are power hogs?
If they could use them all the time, they would, Alan pointed out.
Firing plasma weapons while under stealth would defeat the whole object of the exercise. But if the aliens were careful, that wouldn't matter.
Instead, they don't use them at all during engagements. I think the system has its limits.
So the live feed from the MNF suggests,
the second man said. He didn't have a visible name tag.
But it cut off rather sharply.
Tagger gave him an unreadable look, then turned his attention back to Alan.
How do you propose we proceed?
Alan frowned. He wouldn't be the only one being asked, of course. The records from New Russia had already been forwarded to the Boffins. But he was one of the battle's few survivors. There weren't many people in the Royal Navy who'd engaged the aliens and survived. His insights might be very useful indeed.
And they might also be a waste of time, he thought.
If matters hadn't been so serious, he would have been amused at how they hung on his words.
I was also too close to the battle. The lightly armored carriers are just oversized targets, sir, he said bluntly. The plasma bursts go right through their hulls, often setting off secondary explosions that rip the carriers apart. They really need heavier armor. Even a thin layer of something stronger might give them a better chance to survive.
A thought struck him.
Ark Royal, he added.
The old carrier might move like a wallowing bull, but she was armored so heavily that she might survive a close-range encounter with the aliens.
She's still in service, isn't she?
Tagger's lips flickered into something that could, charitably, be called a smile.
Yes, she is, he said. But that's above your pay grade.
Alan nodded, accepting the rebuke.
Yes, sir.
He paused, considering his next words.
We can also improve the internal armor on the carriers, although that might impede their operational tempo. And we could add additional point defense, maybe even outfit shuttles with close-in weapons to give the carrier some additional protection. But I don't think we can do that much more to give them a chance to survive, sir. The odds are not in their favor.
The Boffins say they can come up with something new, Tagger said. But can they come up with something new in time?
Alan winced. Half the battle was knowing that something was possible. And the aliens had certainly proved that plasma guns and stealth systems were possible. But actually developing such technologies could take months or years, after which they would have to be put into mass production. How long did they have? If the aliens realized the human navies couldn't stand up to them in open battle, they'd abandon the subtle approach and drive on Earth. The war would be lost, along with humanity's homeworld.
We may have to muddle through, he said. But as long as they have such a decisive advantage, sir, the advantage rests in their hands.
Very true, Tagger said.
He glanced at his companion, then nodded.
You have the thanks of a grateful nation, Commander. However, for the moment, you will have to go into lockdown until we decide how best to inform the public. There will be panic when the truth comes out.
And the loss of confidence if the truth is kept secret for too long,
Alan countered. That may be true, Taggart said with a shrug. But the decision was made well above my head. Putting that aside, he met Alan's eyes. How do the escort carriers stand up in combat?
We beat off an enemy probe, sir, Alan said. But we were being worn down. I don't think we would have survived if we hadn't jumped through the tramline. And the lack of pursuit worries me. If they weren't heading straight to Earth, sir, that suggests that their starfighters were operating without a fleet carrier.
Which means that their operational range may be vastly greater than ours, Taggart said. I see your point.
Alan couldn't help being impressed. Intelligence officers were supposed to be smart, to the point where they were too focused on their own brilliance to be effective. But Taggart had understood the implications of Alan's words. All of their comfortable projections about alien ranges, starfighters as well as starships, might be completely wrong. And if that was the case, the aliens might have far more flexibility than any of the Royal Navy's previous opponents. He rubbed his forehead.
The only good news is that their starfighters were apparently unable to transit a tramline without a carrier, he said. But that isn't a particular advantage.
True, Taggart agreed.
The escort carriers also have problems in launching and recovering starfighters, Alan added.
He nodded to the terminal.
It's all in my report, sir. I've suggested a handful of modifications, including additional life support packs, but really, we need a technological breakthrough, and quickly. Time is not on our side.
We know, Taggart said. Your pilots were very sure they could win a one-on-one fight.
Starfighter pilots think they can handle anything, Alan said. I should know, sir. I was one of them. But in reality, we took punishing losses. We would have lost the entire convoy if we hadn't crossed the tramline. Next time, we'll know what we're up against. But unfortunately, the aliens will know too. And they won't be careful next time, he added silently. They know their strengths now.
He yawned suddenly. Being in lockdown was going to be a pain. He'd already rebuked a pair of pilots for talking about a trip to Sin City. It would be fun, but he shook his head. They were going to be in lockdown. There would be no trips outside the hull for anyone. You'll be taken back to your ship, Taggart said. Officer Bennett will be debriefed extensively before we send him back to you. Hopefully we'll have new orders for Haddock within the week, but right now, a great many senior officers are running around like chickens who've had their heads cut off. We don't know what to do.
Neither do we, Alan thought. We need to knock the aliens off balance long enough to recover our footing.
Your country thanks you, Taggart said. And so do I.
Thanks, Alan said. He rose. But will we be remembered after we're gone?
Chapter 20.
Being in lockdown, Abigail had decided very quickly, was boring.
She supposed it was a good thing, in some ways. She hadn't been arrested for sending word of the battle to the Belt Federation, although she knew that could change in a hurry if the ground pounder governments demanded a scapegoat.
The file had leaked very quickly, prompting a number of hurried disclosures from planetside governments. Surprisingly, the Belters had panicked more than the ground pounders. The Belters knew that New Russia wasn't that far away. And the aliens could be probing Terra Nova by now, she thought. The news was maddeningly out of date. They've already occupied a handful of systems surrounding New Russia. She sat on her bridge and read the latest update. Haddock was being repaired as fast as possible, and a new set of modifications were being included. New crewmen and starfighter pilots were already on the way. It looked as though they'd be going out again, unless the aliens attacked Earth first. The news spoke of planetary drafts and mass civil defense preparations, ready for when the aliens took the offensive. Abigail couldn't help feeling that despite everything, the news was oddly optimistic. The planetary governments didn't want the population to feel as though defeat was inevitable. And yet, there was an edge in the news, and the private messages, that suggested the human race was starting to understand it could lose the war. It wasn't something she could put her finger on. The official broadcasts spoke of high confidence and struggled to minimize the losses. But it was there. The universe had changed twice in quick succession. Even though the vast majority of the ground pounder population hadn't managed to emotionally grasp what had happened. It was too distant from their experience for the news to have any significant impact. But to her, a spacer born and bred, there was no hiding from the truth. She flicked the datapad to a new update and frowned. The planetary governments were still implying that the matter would be resolved quickly, although she didn't know who they thought they were fooling. No one would miss the military vets, all of the military vets, being recalled to duty, let alone the draft and weapons training. Even if the war ended tomorrow with a negotiated peace, the long-term effects would be immense. She couldn't help thinking that the ground pounders were trying to pretend that everything was still normal, even though the universe had changed beyond repair. They probably didn't know what else to do. Poddy's console chimed.
Captain, Commander Campbell has returned to the ship.
Another debriefing, Abigail thought. Her debriefings had been remarkably simple, but Alan seemed to be having a harder time. Perhaps the ground pounders were looking for someone to blame. It was the way they normally reacted to cold, hard truth.
At least they let him return to the ship. Ask him to meet me in my cabin, she said, and then tell Anson I want him on the bridge.
Poddy snickered.
He won't like that, Mum.
Probably because he's sharing a cabin with Maddie now, Abigail thought. Her children and the rest of the crew had bitched and moaned about being in lockdown.
I wonder what we're interrupting.
She dismissed the thought with a shrug.
He'll come if he wants to keep his place, she said instead.
She normally didn't bother keeping a watch when they were in harbor, but there was a war on. The aliens could attack the Sol system at any moment.
And if he isn't here in 5 minutes, I will be pissed. Aye, Captain.
Abigail rose and checked the various consoles, making sure that there was nothing in interplanetary space that should concern her. And yet, she knew the apparent lack of alien ships could be an illusion. Sol was the most heavily populated and industrialized system in the human sphere. Her sensors were picking up thousands of interplanetary ships and tiny colonies. But there was still plenty of space for an alien fleet to hide. There were scout ships heading out in all directions, she'd been told. Yet she knew they might be worse than useless. The cold realities of interstellar flight insisted that the aliens would have no trouble getting a fleet to Earth without being detected, as long as they took basic precautions. And they might get very close to the planet before they were spotted. Anson entered, buttoning up his ship suit. He didn't look too annoyed, thankfully. Abigail would have torn him a new asshole if he had dared complain. He was a bridge officer first and foremost, even in harbor. Taking the watch when the captain had to be elsewhere was part of his job. And if he didn't like it, he could go elsewhere. Anson might be her son, but there were limits. The freighter came first.
Alert me if anything happens, she ordered, as she headed for the hatch. I'll be back as soon as possible.
She strode through the hatch and walked down to her cabin. Alan was waiting outside, looking tired and wary. They'd been dancing around each other for weeks, ever since. She sighed inwardly as she opened her cabin. Getting him drunk had been a mistake, and drinking herself had been worse. And sleeping with him. She'd needed the release, she knew, but still.
No alcohol this time, please, Alan said.
Abigail nodded curtly.
Of course. Would you like tea or coffee or chocolate?
Tea would be lovely, Alan said.
He sounded like he needed coffee.
It's been a long day.
At least you were doing something, Abigail said, as she closed the hatch. We've been bumming around in orbit, waiting for something to happen.
Alan smiled, although it didn't quite touch his eyes.
That sounds very restful. It's certainly better than going over the same things time and time again.
Abigail keyed the dispenser to heat the water, then went looking for a pair of mugs.
Didn't they believe the reports?
They don't want to believe the reports, Alan said.
He sat on the chair, resting his hands on his lap.
They're searching for good news and not finding it.
I suppose there's only a limited supply of good news, Abigail said.
She dropped a flavor capsule into the first mug, then filled it with water. The steaming liquid rapidly started to turn brown.
12 fleet carriers blown out of space, and the rest of the fleet just as vulnerable. I can see why they don't want to believe it.
She shrugged. Bad news didn't go away just because someone didn't want to listen. She'd been taught from the very first day she'd held a wrench to understand that reality had to be accepted, whatever it was. It could be something as minor as her crush having no interest in her, or something as major as the fuel tanks running dry. But it had to be accepted before she could come to terms with it. The ground pounder seemed to lack that attitude. She supposed it made sense. For all the horror stories she'd heard about Earth, it couldn't be denied that the environment was a great deal less hostile. On a planet, an air leak wouldn't mean a gruesome death.
But it's still stupid of them, she thought. Those carriers and their crews are dead. They're never going to come back.
She passed him his mug, then sipped her own. Flavor capsules didn't have quite the same taste as tea leaves, but she was in no place to complain. The flavor capsules would last indefinitely, unlike natural food. Natural food was often tastier, but storing it was often a pain in the bum. She had no idea how the interstellar liners handled it. Anyone rich enough to afford an interstellar cruise would throw a tantrum if they were told they had to eat nothing but ration bars. Her lips quirked.
I suppose we might throw a tantrum too.
This tastes better than the wine, Alan said, and it's less distracting.
I'll let you in on a little secret, Abigail said. If you bring a box of tea bags, even very basic tea bags, to an asteroid settlement, you can charge through the nose for it. Everyone drinks tea and coffee out here.
Alan smiled.
You don't grow tea leaves out here?
Most asteroid settlements prefer to grow food, Abigail said.
Earth could afford to grow tea as well as food crops. Asteroid settlements rarely had the space to indulge themselves. Tea might be considered a vital necessity, but everyone knew that it was secondary to food people could actually eat.
It'll be a long time before the colonies start producing luxury goods for themselves.
If they ever do, Alan said.
True, Abigail said. She met his eyes. We need to talk.
His face reddened just slightly. Abigail felt a hot flash of irritation, which she swiftly suppressed. He wasn't a belter. She really shouldn't hold him to the same standards. And yet part of her was frustrated. He might have been born on Earth, but he was serving with a belted crew. It was high time he learned to adapt.
I am sorry, he said finally. The drink made it hard to think straight, and it was a long time, and...
Abigail made a rude sound.
I'm not complaining, she said.
She allowed herself to be deliberately crude, just to shock him.
I wanted to fuck, that it was you.
Oh,
Alan said. He sounded confused.
I don't...
It doesn't matter, Abigail said flatly. We're both adults, and neither of us was drunk enough to be unable to give consent. And I assume,
her voice hardened,
that you tearing at my clothes was a way of giving consent. Unless you want to insist that I raped you.
Alan's face twisted. He looked as though he was torn between shouting in anger and giggling helplessly. She hadn't forced herself on him,
and he knew it. Perhaps it had been a bad decision, one born of a desperate desire to feel human again. But it had been one they'd made together. He could have walked out of her cabin if he hadn't wanted to fuck. She would have let him go.
No, he said. There was a hard undercurrent of anger in his voice, mingled with something.
I don't think you raped me.
Glad to hear it, Abigail said.
She'd done nothing wrong by Belter standards, but ground pounders had different attitudes, and the Navy had countless rules and regulations governing sex. Clearly, the bureaucrats didn't trust their subordinates to be responsible adults. The Belt took a simpler approach.
Can I be blunt?
I have never heard you trying to be anything but, Alan told her.
Abigail laughed, then leaned forward.
I wanted to feel human again, after everything, she said. You were convenient. And I imagine you felt the same way.
Yeah, Alan said.
I'm not going to demand you marry me, Abigail said.
She'd watched historical VRs, where sex always led to marriage, although she found them hard to believe. Was that really how ground pounders did things?
But what I want, what I need, is you working with me. Like it or not, there is a war on. Afterwards, you can do whatever the hell you please.
Alan studied her for a long moment.
Did it really mean so little to you?
Abigail resisted, barely, the temptation to roll her eyes.
Did it actually mean anything to you?
I don't know, Alan said. I haven't had sex for nearly 5 years. And new.
And now you feel like a teenage boy who thinks his first girlfriend is his one and only,
Abigail said.
God, she hoped Anson didn't feel that way about Maddie. You're old enough to know better, aren't you? You're what? 100? A couple of 100?
Old enough to know better, Alan said tartly.
Good, Abigail said.
She pointed a finger at his chest.
It was good. I needed it, and so did you. And if you want to do it again, I might say yes. But I can't have you avoiding me or being so painfully formal that everyone knows we did something. Understand?
Yes, Alan said. He paused. You want to do it again?
Later, Abigail said. She glanced at her wristcomb. I shouldn't leave Anson on the bridge for too long.
Alan nodded. Abigail couldn't tell if he was disappointed or not. She reminded herself, once again, that belters and ground pounders were different. Perhaps she'd be considered too old on Earth, even though she was only 45. Or perhaps he'd invested more emotion in the sex than she'd realized. It was hard to understand sometimes how ground pounders actually managed to function in society. Their safe environment made them soft.
I understand, Alan said.
He took a sip of his tea.
Are all belters like you?
Abigail took a moment to consider.
In what way?
In being so blunt, Alan said.
And in...
He didn't seem to know how to finish the sentence. Abigail gave in, this time, to the temptation to roll her eyes. Ground pounders were so strange.
The Belt is a blunt place, she said. There can be no room for misunderstandings. We speak the same language in all respects. Yes, we're blunt, because anything less could lead to tragedy. And we can't afford to pussyfoot around. Sex? No one cares who fucks who, or how they do it, as long as it's between consenting adults in private. No one back home will give a damn that we fucked. They will care if our relationship buggers up the mission.
Alan frowned.
Why?
Because we're adults, Abigail said, and we're supposed to be responsible.
She frowned.
Do your daughters not work now?
Alan blinked in surprise.
Jeanette is 12.
Old enough to learn the basics, Abigail said. I shipped out when I was 14.
She sighed. She'd watched a handful of dramas set on Earth, but she'd never really believed they were real.
There were only so many shows about adults acting like oversized children one could take before deciding there was no intelligent life on the planet. She dreaded to think what her parents would have said if she had acted like a 5-year-old when she'd been 15. She'd be lucky not to be unceremoniously disowned for irredeemable idiocy. Her uncle had always said that stupidity killed, and she knew, from bitter experience, that he had been right.
"Jeanette is too young to work," Alan said. "She won't even be able to take on an apprenticeship until she turns 16, and only then if she leaves school."
"And is she learning anything useful at school?"
Abigail found it hard to comprehend how anyone could send their child to a ground pounder school.
"What will she be when she finally grows up?"
"I don't know," Alan said. "I haven't heard from her in years.
He shook his head slowly.
"I was in jail," he reminded her. "We lost touch."
Abigail winced. She wasn't sure if she should feel sorry for him or slap him. Hard. Family was family. And while Alan's daughters had every right to hate their father, they were still family. He shouldn't abandon his child.
"It wouldn't happen in the belt," she thought tartly. "None of this would happen in the belt." "Write to her," she said. "Write to both of them. Give them a chance to get back in touch with their father."
Alan looked at her as if she'd said something really stupid.
"Do you think they want to get in touch with me? I killed their mother."
"Give them the choice," Abigail urged.
She found it hard to imagine how Jeanette and her sister felt about their father. But then she couldn't imagine her father killing her mother either.
"At the very least, they deserve a chance to hear your side of the story."
"I killed your mother in a fit of rage," Alan said dryly. "I don't think they'll want to hear that."
He laughed humorlessly.
"Do you know what would have happened if I'd filed for divorce?"
Abigail shrugged. She had no idea.
"She would have been hammered by the courts," Alan told her. "There are laws against adultery if one partner is in the military. It was bad for morale, apparently, when a man's wife cheated on him while he was at the front. And socially, she would have been crucified. It wouldn't have been hard for her to wait until I got home, then ask for a separation. No one would have blamed her for that."
"Except you," Abigail said.
"But I was too angry to care," Alan said.
He looked down at his hands, perhaps imagining them covered with blood.
"And I killed her. And I..."
"And nothing,"
Abigail said. She met his eyes, daring him to say something.
"You ground pounders and your warped ideas about sex."
She glanced at her wristcom again.
"Be an adult. Do your job. And while you're at it, record a message for your daughters. The next mission might kill you. Give them a fucking chance to get back in touch before it's too late."
"Thank you," Alan said sourly.
"You're welcome," Abigail told him.
She rose.
"I'll see you for dinner. Until then, go write that letter or record a V-mail. Or something."
"If you wish," Alan said.
Abigail shrugged.
"I'm not telling you this for my sake," she said,
although she knew that wasn't entirely true.
"I'm doing it so you'll be in a better state when we go back to war."
"How ruthlessly practical,"
Alan said.
"That's the belt in a nutshell,"
Abigail said bluntly. It was the way she had lived right from the start. Her family wouldn't have accepted anything else.
"Ruthlessly practical is how we live."
Chapter 21.
"We're being called to the station,"
Bennett said.
"Grab your jacket and let's go."
Alan nodded in relief as he sat up. He'd spent the last 2 hours in his cabin, trying to write a letter to the girls. Abigail had been right, he acknowledged, but he had no idea what to say to them. The in-laws had probably poisoned their minds against him. Not, he supposed, as he reached for his jacket, that they'd have to work very hard.
There was no denying that the reason his daughters were growing up without a mother was that their father had killed their mother.
And they never liked me anyway,
he reminded himself.
They thought I wasn't good enough for their daughter.
He pulled on his jacket and followed Bennett down to the shuttle. Abigail met them there, looking disgustingly fresh for someone who'd been on the bridge for at least 2 hours, perhaps longer. Alan nodded to her. He didn't have time to sort out his feelings, as they stepped through the hatch and into the shuttle. The pilot undocked as soon as they were on board, taking the shuttle directly to the asteroid base. Alan glanced at the scanner and saw 5 other converted freighters and a pair of frigates holding position near the station. The Royal Navy had clearly decided to do something. The shuttle docked with a loud clang, the hatch hissing open a second later. A pair of Royal Marines met them, checking their IDs before hurrying them into the briefing room. Alan looked around, spotting a handful of military and civilian personnel waiting for them. He couldn't help wondering what crimes the military personnel might have committed if they'd been assigned to the escort carriers. There weren't many possibilities. Someone considered to be a permanent risk would never be let out of jail if he hadn't simply been hanged. Society wasn't kind to serious criminals.
Perhaps they just fiddled their expenses,
Alan thought, as he sat down next to Abigail.
Or some other harmless little prank, like talking back to a senior officer.
He looked up as a man strode into the room, the lights dimming as he took the podium.
Thank you for coming, he said briskly. For those of you who don't know me, I am Commodore Sidney Jameson, currently in command of Task Force Woodbine. You and your ships have been assigned to my command.
Woodbine,
Alan thought, amused. The MOD assigned operational code names at random, unlike the Americans, who tried to be dramatic, but he felt the Admiralty might prefer something a little more purposeful. And yet being dramatic had its disadvantages.
I suppose the Yanks always did tip off their enemies when the names became public.
He studied Jameson for a long moment. The brown-haired officer looked young, suspiciously young, to be a Commodore. Good genes, or the old boys' network? Alan was inclined to think the latter. An older man would have given an impression of being more mature, even if his face appeared young. Jameson probably had friends in high places. The name was common enough not to suggest any aristocratic ties, but that meant nothing. There was no shortage of aristocrats who insisted on serving under false names.
You'll receive a complete set of briefing notes once this meeting is over, Jameson informed them. However, I will go over the basics to make sure we're all caterwauling off the same song sheet.
And to prove you love to hear yourself talk,
Alan thought rudely.
Are you ever going to get to the point?
The Admiralty has conducted an extensive analysis of the records from New Russia, Jameson continued. It is their conclusion that we are dangerously outmatched in space combat.
No shit, Sherlock,
someone muttered from the back. Jameson showed no visible reaction.
The plasma weapons are just one part of the problem, he added. Our analysis suggests that the aliens entered the New Russia system through a weak tramline, one of the gravitational lines we believed was too weak to allow starships to transit. We're not entirely sure of this, I should admit, but their attack force did come in on a vector that leads back to the weak tramline.
Alan glanced at Abigail, who looked as stunned as he felt. The analyst could be wrong, of course. He certainly wanted to believe they were wrong. There was no reason the aliens couldn't have jumped through any of the usable tramlines, then sneaked around the system until finally selecting their attack vector and moving in for the kill. And yet, the longer they delayed before the attack, the greater the chance of being spotted. Sheer practicality alone suggested that the analysts might be right.
And there's no sign the aliens think that differently from us, he told himself. Technology aside, their tactics are entirely conventional.
If this is accurate, the situation is grave, Jameson warned. I don't believe I have to explain the implications.
He tapped a switch,
activating the holographic star chart. A network of tramlines appeared in front of them, a handful shaded in red. Alan felt a chill run down his spine as he picked out the tramlines that had been supposed to be inaccessible. If the aliens really could use them, they could outflank the defenders and thrust straight at Earth. Gasps echoed around the room as the audience worked it out for themselves. They were all experienced spacers. They knew the realities of spaceflight. The new tramlines would change the universe once again.
"We may be wrong about this," Jameson cautioned, "but there is enough evidence to back up the analysis."
Alan gritted his teeth. The nature of the tramlines made it impossible to fortify them. None of the great powers, or all of them working together, could hope to line a single tramline with orbital battle stations. The costs would be staggering, the requirements utterly incomprehensible. And even if they fortified one tramline to the point where any intrusion could be detected and destroyed, the others could still be used. That was one of the realities of interstellar spaceflight. They all understood how the tramline shaped interstellar commerce and war. But if the aliens could use inaccessible tramlines, they could evade most of the outer colonies and make their way directly to Earth without fear of interception. That alone limited humanity. There was no way they could spare forces for the outer colonies if Earth itself might be attacked at any moment. But the deeper implications were worse. No one knew where the aliens were based, save for a rough idea of their general location. And yet, if the only link between human and alien space was an inaccessible tramline,
"We might not be able to get at them," he thought.
Someone coughed for attention.
"Do the Buffins have any theories about how this could be done?"
"Not as yet," Jameson said. "I've been given to understand that research is underway. But beyond that, I know nothing."
He cleared his throat.
"Precisely how we stack up against them on the ground is unknown, but unlikely to matter. As long as they control the high orbitals, they can smash resistance with ease. We believe that it is only a matter of time before the aliens mount an offensive against Earth itself. The defenders are scrambling to get ready for the attack. The Boffins have identified a number of ways to minimize the alien advantages, but we need time. That's where we come in."
"Of course," Alan thought. "The Admiralty wants us to go out and commit suicide to buy time."
"Intelligence has been doing its level best to watch the aliens," Jameson informed them. "We do not, as yet, know anything about their physical form, let alone their language, internal politics, and, most importantly of all, the reason they started the war. Infiltrating their society is obviously impossible, as we know next to nothing about them. However, we have been tracking their movements as best as we can, and we have uncovered something interesting. It may give us a chance to take the offensive and score a victory of our own."
He altered the star chart, zeroing in on a single system near New Russia.
"Our analysis of their tramlines is not yet complete," he said. "However, we believe they're running supplies through this system. To us, the system is on the far end of a tramline chain and thus useless for anything other than a black colony. To them, the system is potentially a transit point. If our analysis is correct, they're using the system to support their offensive."
Alan frowned, stroking his chin as he studied the display. It made sense, he supposed, if one accepted that the aliens could ride previously inaccessible tramlines. The unnamed system, no one had bothered to give it any more than a numerical designation, was only two jumps from New Russia if one used the weaker tramlines. Coming to think of it, the alien attack force might well have come through the system itself. It was certainly on the right vector.
"And it would allow them to outflank our scouts," he thought. "If, of course, they can use the weaker tramlines."
"Our mission is to get into the system, then intercept and destroy any alien convoys that pass through the tramlines," Jameson said. "We believe that they will feel reasonably safe
as the system is of very limited use to us. Hitting their convoys will give them a nasty surprise and force them to reassess their tactics. It will also, hopefully, slow their preparations for an assault on Earth.
Makes sense,
Abigail muttered. Alan nodded in agreement. Few civilians understood the logistics of interstellar spaceflight and interstellar war, either. The alien fleet would require replenishing before it proceeded onwards, unless they'd brought their fleet train with them. But that would have been very dangerous if the battle for New Russia had gone the other way. No, the aliens would need to run everything from freighters to troop transport through the tramline chain before they advanced towards Earth. The plan made sense.
Ideally, we'll try to capture their freighters rather than destroy them, Jameson added. I don't think I need to tell you just how important it is to capture samples of alien technology for the boffins to study. But if worst comes to worst, aim to destroy the ships instead of letting them go. We must buy time for Earth to prepare for the coming storm.
There was a long pause.
Are there any questions?
Abigail leaned forward.
The quickest route to this system would take us within a jump of New Russia, she said. Would we not be running the risk of encountering the aliens before we reached our destination?
Yes, we will, Jameson said.
He nodded at the star chart.
Our last reports, which are about a week out of date, suggest that the aliens have occupied all the star systems within a jump of New Russia. So far, there's been no reports that they have landed on Clement or Oswego, but they smashed asteroid habitats in both the Oswego and Carissa systems. The remaining settlements in the systems have gone dark.
He took a long breath.
Yes, there is a very good chance that we will encounter the aliens prior to reaching our target. But there is very little we can do about that, save for sneaking around the edge of the systems rather than trying to get close to them.
It will add several days to our journey, at best,
Alan pointed out.
I know, Jameson said. And so does the Admiralty. Something, I haven't been told what, will also take place at roughly the same time, hopefully distracting the aliens. But the time delay alone may make it difficult for the aliens to realize that they're meant to be distracted. The timing is very far from precise, so we'll do everything in our power to avoid a confrontation until we reach our destination.
And if you're wrong, we die,
Alan thought. He looked at the star chart, trying to gather his thoughts. He'd been expendable as a starfighter pilot, but now... He shook his head. Losing the escort carriers wouldn't materially affect the balance of power, as far as anyone knew. The odds were already stacked against humanity. If they could distract the aliens, throw them back on their heels, it would be worth any price. He didn't like the thought of dying, but it would be worth it.
And it isn't like I have much of a future anyway, he thought.
If he couldn't put together a letter to his daughters, why in the name of God Almighty should he be able to slip back into their lives?
Better I die amidst the stars than go home, even as a war hero. My past will haunt me, wherever I go.
Jameson was speaking. Alan dragged his attention back to the younger man.
New starfighter pilots and starfighters, Jameson said. Ideally, you'll be ready to depart in 2 days.
Captain Chester leaned forward.
Am I to understand that my pilots will have no time to train together?
Shit,
Alan thought. He hadn't heard everything Jameson had said, but he could guess the rest.
No time to get the newcomers integrated into the rest of the squadrons?
We don't have time for much of anything, Jameson said sharply. You'll have to rely on simulations.
Brilliant,
Alan thought sarcastically. Jameson seemed to understand the problem, but he wasn't doing anything to fix it. And yet, was there anything he could do? A week spent training might cost them their chance to do real damage. But then, not training might also cost them their chance to hurt the enemy.
We'll get our asses kicked if we don't train,
It isn't good enough, Captain Chester said.
There was a dull murmur of agreement from the others.
Commodore, we need time.
We don't have the time,
Jameson cut him off.
I understand the problem, Captain. In an ideal world, we'd have plenty of time to train until the pilots could fly their starfighters in their sleep. But we don't have the time. If we don't manage to cripple the enemy, even hurt them just a little, we will lose the war.
We may lose it anyway, Alan thought.
He shivered. It was a truism that Britain could not be defeated. Britain was a great power, capable of destroying any of the other great powers. A small war could be lost, perhaps, but a bigger one? The great powers knew better than to let one take place. But the aliens were an outside context problem, their mere existence changing the balance of power. A total defeat had been unthinkable only a few short months ago. Now, it was possible.
And will they enslave the entire human race? He wondered. Or will they destroy us?
There will also be some modified scanners and remote sensor platforms, Jameson added slowly. We believe they may be effective against the alien stealth systems, but we don't know for sure. We'll be testing them in combat for the first time. Joy, Abigail muttered.
Alan nodded. In his experience, new technology, no matter how much it was hyped, always produced unexpected surprises when it was taken into the field. He would have preferred to test the new systems thoroughly before trying to use them in combat. But it looked as though they weren't going to have a choice. Besides, the systems probably couldn't be tested outside combat.
We will depart in 2 days, once the remaining personnel have arrived, Jameson concluded.
His gaze swept the room.
I am aware of the problems. This would not be an easy mission, even under better circumstances. But I don't think we have any choice. We need to buy time, and right now, we don't dare risk a major clash. Hitting their supply lines is our best bet.
He nodded slowly.
Thank you for coming, he said. Dismissed.
Abigail caught Alan's arm as they headed for the hatch.
Do you have time to get your people ready?
I hope so, Alan said. Time is not going to be on our side.
He scowled, considering the problem. They knew enough about the aliens now to run some proper simulations, but nothing beat actual exercises. Perhaps they could hold a couple before they made their way into disputed territory. Jameson probably wouldn't object to that, as long as the squadron didn't slow down. It wouldn't be ideal, but it would be better than relying on simulations. Emergency drills always left out the emergency.
I don't think we have a choice, he said.
Abigail could leave, he supposed, although she might wind up being charged with desertion. He, on the other hand, would be going straight back to jail.
The Commodore is right. If we can't buy time for Earth, we could lose the war.
And the aliens don't seem inclined to take prisoners, Abigail agreed. That bodes ill for the future.
Alan nodded. It was impossible to say how many life pods had been launched before the MNF had been annihilated, let alone what the aliens had done with them. Perhaps, just perhaps, they'd been allowed to land on New Russia. Or, equally possible, they'd been blasted out of space. Or left afloat forever, utterly alone. The aliens might have watched from stealth, hoping the emergency beacons would lure a stray ship into range. But was there anyone left to listen for the beacons, let alone try to rescue the life pods? He shivered. He didn't know.
We'd better get back to the ship, Abigail said.
She patted his back.
It looks like we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
Alan said. He supposed she was trying to be reassuring. It wasn't working.
We have far too much work to do. And the damned letter to write,
he added silently.
I can't procrastinate any longer.
Chapter 22. Alan tried, hard, to hide his wince as he strode into the briefing compartment, Bennett dogging his heels like an overgrown puppy. There were just too many new faces in the crowd, ranging from pilots so young he couldn't help feeling they should be in diapers, to pilots so old he had grave doubts about their reflexes. Starfighter piloting was a young man's game. Old age and experience might beat youth and speed in the movies, but it was a different story in real life.
"At least we got to keep a couple of pilots from the other ships," he thought. "But they took some of our experienced pilots in exchange."
He felt a flash of déjà vu as the compartment quieted, slowly. He had been here before, back when they'd been preparing for the convoy to New Russia. The faces were different, but the intent was the same. And yet, it was different, too. They'd known the universe had changed, but they hadn't believed it. They sure as hell believed it now.
"Welcome on board," he said.
He winced again as he surveyed the room. The newcomers were all too easy to spot.
"I hope you all managed to claim your bunks and stow your bags without trouble. I also hope, for the newcomers, that your bunkmates warn you that this is a dry ship. No alcohol, no drugs, nothing that might distract you from the mission. I'll be checking your bags later, so if there's anything you don't want me to find, I suggest you send it back to the station. There will be no further warnings."
There was a faint murmur of irritation. He ignored it.
"Those of you who weren't at New Russia should have had a chance to review the recordings," he continued. "If you haven't done so, do so now. You have to understand what we'll be up against when we reach our destination. The aliens are not gods, but they are powerful, and they know how to use their advantages against us. I'm counting on you, all of you, to stand your ground when we encounter them for the second time. This war is a war for survival. We are all expendable in the defense of our homeworld and our people. I've heard some of the stories from the training centers, from snide jokes about grey hairs, to suggestions that some of the recruits have to be taught how to go potty. Forget them, right now. You're here because you passed the basic proficiency tests, and because your country needs you. Your planet needs you. We need you to work as a team, not sharpen your claws on each other. If any of you, and I mean any of you, tries to break apart the team for whatever reason, you'd better damn well hope the aliens kill you before I do."
He paused just long enough to allow his words to sink in, then looked at Maddie.
"The floor is yours."
"The ceiling is ours,"
Green said quickly. Alan glared him into silence.
"Maddie?"
Maddie took a breath.
"Post-battle assessments of the alien starfighters suggested?"
Alan watched their faces as Maddie spoke, quietly noting who was listening and who was too self-obsessed to pay attention. They weren't quite the dregs of the service, but they weren't the Royal Navy's aces either. Too many of them had died at New Russia. The younger pilots had been rushed through the training program, while the older reservists had spent years out of a cockpit. Too many of them hadn't bothered to keep up with their training either. Alan had a feeling that there were going to be a few changes once the war was over, if humanity survived. The entire reservist system was buckling under the strain of so many people having to rejoin the Navy at short notice.
"And the older pilots will be a steadying influence," he told himself firmly. "Perhaps they can keep the younger pilots in check."
He didn't think the message was really sinking in, not amongst the younger pilots. They'd been taught to be hot dogs, to use their craft to best advantage, but the threat environment had changed sharply. They might have flown the trench run in the simulators. No one had ever had to launch a torpedo into an exhaust vent on a moon-sized starship in real life, yet they'd never experienced so much counter-battery fire. The aliens might be able to shoot torpedoes out of space, just by filling space with plasma bolts. They'd have pretty low odds of hitting anything with a single blast, but they fired so many that the odds tipped sharply in their favor.
And if they managed to improve their targeting, he thought grimly, they might wipe out entire wings before they get into attack position. You won't feel that in your bones. Not yet, he said, when Maddie had finished.
She'd kept herself strictly to the facts, but very few of the newcomers looked convinced.
You won't grasp the sheer power they possess. That's why we're going to be in the simulators, sparring with their craft, until you all understand what we face. And this time,
he hardened his voice,
the aliens will not have any computer-given advantages. You will be facing them as they really are.
He sucked in his breath, wondering how many of them would actually believe him. Their trainers at the Lunar Academy had always tipped the balance in favor of the enemy, giving them speeds and accuracy that were almost superhumanly good. The simulated enemy always scored hits when the computers deemed there was a greater than 40% chance of hitting the target. It wasn't officially discussed, but everyone knew the simulations were tougher than reality. And when they asked, they always got the same answer. Hard training, easy mission. Easy training, hard mission. But the aliens were just too good to simulate, not without making them completely unbeatable. Humanity did have some advantages. The analysts had made that clear, but not enough to give them an edge. A Spitfire or a Hurricane starfighter enjoyed greater accuracy than their alien enemies. Yet what did that matter when the aliens could fill space with lethal plasma bolts?
I'll be checking your quarters in 30 minutes, he said,
making a show of checking his wristcom.
After that, we'll be going straight into the simulators. If you haven't freshened up, make sure you do. There won't be another chance. Any questions?
A pilot stuck up his hand.
Is it true we're getting long-range life support packs?
Yes,
Alan said bluntly. He wasn't looking forward to using them, but the packs might come in handy.
And a few other surprises, too.
He looked from face to face, then nodded to himself.
Dismissed.
The pilots rose and filed out of the room. He met Maddie's eyes and nodded to the hatch, silently ordering her to leave, too. The hatch closed behind her, leaving him alone. He looked at the datapad, unsure if he wanted to see a new message or not. He'd written a letter to his daughters the night after the briefing, but there had been no reply. It didn't bode well, he feared. Jeanette had never had any trouble responding instantly to her friends, even when she'd been 7 years old. Perhaps she was just having problems deciding what to say.
Or perhaps the in-laws have told her not to reply, Alan thought.
There were no rules barring him from visiting his family, but he'd been in jail. And he didn't think he'd be allowed to leave the ship long enough to go to Earth, even if he wanted to.
God alone knows what the in-laws told them.
His inbox wasn't empty, but none of the messages were particularly important. The bean counter seemed to believe he needed hundreds of generalized updates, very few of which had anything to do with him. And he'd signed up for a handful of news services, hoping to catch up on how politics and technology had evolved while he'd been in jail. There had been very little news in Colchester, and he hadn't paid attention. Not really. He didn't even know the name of the Prime Minister. He opened the first message and read it quickly, trying to read between the lines. There would be sensors in each of the news offices now, invoking Dora and making sure that the editors didn't print anything without prior approval. No matter what happened, most of the news was terribly bland. No actual untruths, as far as he could tell, but a great deal of misdirection. The government would probably get away with it, too. Sir Charles Hanover had believed the media to be nothing more than enemy combatants, and he'd slapped all sorts of control laws on them. Hanover might be dead, but the laws lived on. And yet, reading between the lines, there were hints of trouble, of people becoming aware of the truth. There was a sense that the ground was shifting, of the world changing in an unpredictable way. That nothing, perhaps, would ever be the same again. He remembered reading some memoirs from the world before the Troubles. Memoirs written by people who had tried not to think about the way society was slowly tearing itself apart. They hadn't wanted to acknowledge it, he recalled. Acknowledging that their sacred cows were nothing of the sort would have broken them. The more honest ones, in hindsight, had recognized the truth. They'd been nothing more than useful idiots. Alan shivered, despite himself. He'd once been caught in a blowout, a hiss of escaping air, all the warning he'd had before the gravity had failed, and he'd plunged towards the hull breach. It had been a drill, an unannounced drill. There had been no real danger. And yet, just for a second, time had seemed to freeze while the awful truth had dawned on him. Now, it was no drill. 12 fleet carriers were dead. The rest of the fleet might not be enough to stop the aliens.
You're being maudlin, he told himself sharply. Stop it!
His wristcom bleeped. It was time to inspect the pilot quarters. And he hoped, as he rose and walked to the hatch, that they'd listen to him. He wanted to chew someone's ass, just to make it clear that they had to listen. But he didn't have time. There was too much else to do.
At least it will keep me busy, he thought. I'll have no time to brood.
The fleet command network has been updated, Anson said. You're apparently third in command of the fleet.
Flotilla, Abigail corrected. Calling 7 ships a fleet is a little unbelievable. Poddy coughed.
Do you get extra pay?
I don't think so, Anson said.
Just command.
If Commodore Jameson and Captain Smith get blown away. Abigail nodded, studying the display. 5 escort carriers and 2 frigates held station near Talliman, the latter playing host to Commodore Jameson and his staff. She had to give him credit for risking his ass as well as hers, particularly as the frigates would draw a great deal of enemy fire. The engineers had bolted extra armor to the hull, as well as additional close-in-point defense weapons. But Abigail had her doubts. There was no way the frigates could carry the same weight of armor as Ark Royal.
And we can't either, she thought. We're as defenseless as a newborn baby.
She scowled. The extra plating might help if the aliens strafed the ship, or it might not. She would be happier, she admitted privately, if she knew for sure. Her simulations suggested it might give them some extra survivability, but it depended on what assumptions were programmed into the computers. The only good news, as far as she could tell, was that the enemy plasma cannons were apparently short-range weapons. They didn't have to worry about being sniped from extreme range. Anson coughed.
Mum?
Abigail gave him a sharp look.
I think that we'll have more important things to worry about if I take command, she said flatly.
Losing both frigates would be bad, not least because the aliens could then concentrate on the escort carriers. The chances were the aliens now knew a great deal about what Haddock and her sisters could do.
Do we have an updated flight path yet?
No change, Anson told her.
I think he's planning to reconsider if we run into trouble.
Smart move, Abigail agreed. She silently gave Jameson credit for that, too.
We have no way to know how the situation might have changed in the last few days.
She checked the latest set of reports, silently grateful that the bean counters, for once, had been silenced. Alan had told her that he no longer needed to file requests in triplicate to get what he wanted, as long as it could be found. Haddock had been resupplied with everything from medical gear to food, drink, and even a handful of portable gaming machines. Abigail wasn't sure if there was a valid use for the machines or not, but she had to admit their presence was a good sign. And yet, it was worrying, too. A great deal depended on their mission.
We have to buy time, she thought. And if that costs us our lives?
It wasn't something she'd thought about before the war. She'd been a patriot, but a belter patriot. She'd feared, as had many others, that there would be a clash between the great powers and the Belter Federation. She'd known, if that day had come, that you would have to choose a side. And yet interplanetary war had always seemed pointless. The Belt had imposed change, even on Russian or Chinese facilities. They hadn't had a choice, not when their best personnel started to desert. The great powers might win the war, only to discover that they'd laid the seeds for the next war. But now, the universe had changed, and the Belt could not stand alone. She was a human patriot now, just as they all were. The ruthless pragmatism of the Belt demanded it. But would everyone else feel the same way? Or was her sacrifice going to pass unremarked? Poddy cleared her throat.
"Signal from the flag, Mum," she said. "We're leaving at 1900 hours precisely."
Abigail nodded.
"Spread the word," she said, "and remind everyone that this is their last chance to write a will. They'll want to make sure everyone knows what they want to do with their ill-gotten gains."
She smiled at the thought, although it wasn't really funny. The Royal Navy had paid a major bonus for the combat recordings. Maybe not enough to repay the loan she'd taken out years ago, but enough to put her in a very good position if she wanted to buy another ship. And even the junior crewers on Haddock had enough bonus money to give them an excellent chance of buying a ship of their own. Some of them would certainly want to do so after the war. It wasn't something she wanted to discourage.
"And Anson might be able to get a loan from the rest of the family, if he wants a ship himself," she thought. "It would take him years to repay it, but the terms would be good."
Her heart sank as she realized it might not be so easy to buy a starship after the war. The civilian shipyards were already being repurposed to construct warships rather than commercial ships. And even if the war ended, there would be a push to rebuild the space navies rather than the interstellar shipping fleets. Anson and Poddy might have the cash, but would they find anyone willing to sell?
"Stop worrying about the future," she told herself as she rose. "The future can take care of itself. The present is now."
Leaving Anson in command, she walked her ship from bow to stern, inspecting each and every one of the refits and modifications. The engineers had done a good job, she considered, although the workhorse freighters had been designed to be easy to repair or modify. Whoever had approved the design had shown a grasp of long-term thinking she'd assumed to be beyond most ground pounders. Haddock still wasn't a warship. She was too slow and bulky to be effective in a knife-range fight, but she did have some advantages of her own. Abigail just wished they had more armor. She returned to the bridge as the drive started to power up, a low thrumming echoing through the hull. The last set of reports were on her display, waiting for her. Haddock was as ready as she was ever going to be. The engineers had already disembarked. Abigail felt a pang of regret, mingled with the grim awareness that extra engineers wouldn't help if they came under heavy attack. Haddock wouldn't survive if the aliens bore down on her with all their might. She didn't know any starship that would.
"The flag is signaling for us to take our place in formation,"
Poddy said.
"Anson, take us out,"
Abigail ordered. She braced herself as the drives grew louder.
"And then follow the flag to the tramline."
"Aye, Captain."
Abigail felt her gut clench. She'd thought she'd understood there was a war on, but she hadn't until she'd actually seen the aliens. This was no genteel shoving match between great powers, or a punitive expedition against a rogue state. This was a war to the death, with no surrenders accepted. And humanity could lose. She shook her head slowly. She'd read all the speculations, all the suggestions that humanity had somehow mortally offended an alien foe, or that the human form might be terrifyingly ugly to the aliens. But none of them meant anything, compared to the simple fact that the aliens had started the war. And now humanity had to fight or die.
"And now we're on our way again," she thought. "Who knows what we'll run into this time?"
Chapter 23.
You have to remain focused on the targets,
Alan said, irritated.
The aliens move like flies on a griddle.
He fought to keep his voice even as he studied the latest set of stats. The old hands, and it was strange thinking of men who were barely out of their teens as old, had done a good job, but the newcomers hadn't done anything like so well. It was a very different threat environment to the one they'd trained for, he had to admit. Yet they had to adapt to the new world. The aliens wouldn't give them a chance to learn from their mistakes. His eyes swept the briefing room.
This isn't a simulation where everything is hyped up a little, just to keep you on your toes, he added. The alien craft truly are that good, and their point defense is a nightmare. It's too good,
Flight Lieutenant Thomas Andrews said. He was one of the older pilots, nearly 10 years out of the cockpit.
How are we meant to get a torpedo run through that level of firepower?
Keep dodging, Grandad,
Green said.
They can't fill every last millimeter of space with plasma fire.
They're certainly trying,
Andrews snapped back.
It's starting to look like we need mass drivers, not torpedoes.
I believe the boffins are working on them,
Alan said. Mass drivers had been regarded as weapons of mass destruction for years, and there had been a tacit agreement amongst the great powers not to build them. In hindsight, that might have been a mistake. A solid projectile might soak up plasma fire before it slammed into a target and punched right through the hull.
However, we have to make do with what we have.
He tapped the display.
Next time, I want Herring to cover Keeper as you push the offensive, he added. And I expect all of you to work on your flying. Let the computers handle the firing. They're better at snapshooting in any case.
Perhaps some of us should take drugs,
Green muttered.
Their reflexes are dull.
At least we're trying,
Andrew said.
You decided to clown around while we were flying into the teeth of enemy fire.
Quiet,
Alan snapped, before a real argument could break out.
Like I said, we have to make do with what we have. And that means all of you working together. If you have a problem with it, complain to the Admiralty. I'm sure they will be glad to hear from you.
He sighed inwardly as his eyes swept the compartment. There were drugs that enhanced reflexes, but they tended to come with unexpected and unwanted side effects. Pilots were not allowed to use them unless the situation was truly dire. Even now, Alan doubted the Admiralty would endorse their use, certainly not on a regular basis. The possible consequences were too bad.
We'll resume our simulations in an hour, he said. Get something to eat, then report back to the simulators. And be prepared to be flying for hours. Dismissed.
He watched the pilots leave, then sat back in his chair.
I feel old. You don't look a day over 100,
Bennett said dryly. He sat in the corner, reading a datapad.
And some of those pilots are older than you.
Alan nodded shortly. The reservists were trying, but it was achingly clear that some of them had seen the reserves as a chance to earn a retainer while doing very little, while others weren't in the best physical state. They understood the importance of what they were doing, and the implications of losing so many starfighters and fleet carriers, but their reflexes weren't up to standard. Normally, none of them would be allowed to fly anything more complicated than a shuttle.
This is the new normal, he told himself. Get used to it.
He glanced at the report on the datapad, forwarded from one of the pickets in the Asimov system. The aliens hadn't moved after occupying a handful of systems near New Russia. It bothered Alan more than he cared to admit. They had to be planning something. But what? It wasn't even clear if they could read and understand human data files. If they couldn't, they'd have to find their way to Earth through extensive survey work.
Don't count on it, he thought sourly. We don't dare assume they didn't manage to recover astrographic data.
Not, he supposed, that it mattered. With care, the aliens could have surveyed most of human space over the last couple of years, without triggering any alarms. No one had been watching for aliens, after all. Any stray sensor contacts at the edge of a populated star system would be dismissed as vacuum fluctuations or sensor glitches, instead of an alien fleet. The aliens could have brought their forces all the way to Earth without being detected, if they knew where to go. He supposed that, if nothing else, was a sign the aliens didn't know anything about the internal astrography of the human sphere.
"We have 3 weeks to go," he said. "Do you think we have a chance?"
Bennett shrugged.
"You're the CAG," he said. "What do you think?"
"I think we're going to take some pretty heavy losses," Alan said.
He studied the star chart thoughtfully. It wouldn't be long before they started to crawl through occupied space, making their way to their destination.
"And they might be able to catch us while we're sneaking back."
"Worry about the mission first," Bennett said. "Extraction will come later."
Alan shot him an odd look.
"Was that what they taught you?"
"We were always trying to balance pre-mission planning with improvisation and muddling through," Bennett told him. "There was always something that threw the plans out of sync.
No battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy,"
Alan agreed.
"Quite," Bennett said. "And the man on the spot is the one best qualified to decide what to do."
Alan shrugged. He was the man on the spot, as far as he could tell, but he didn't feel as though he knew what to do. No, that wasn't quite accurate. He knew what he wanted to do, but he knew he couldn't do it. The older reservists were the only pilots available to reinforce his squadrons, while the younger ones went to fleet carriers or orbital bases. He understood the cold logic all too well. His pilots were expendable. And yet he didn't like it. How could he? Bennett rose.
"Keep designing your simulations," he said, "and keep altering the parameters. You don't want them to get complacent."
"I doubt anyone will,"
Alan said. He held up the datapad.
"Our most successful mission cost us 2/3 of our starfighters and 3 of the carriers. One real mission like that will be enough to ruin us."
"It depends, I suppose," Bennett said. "How much harm would you do to the enemy?"
Alan watched him go, feeling tired. There was no hope of actually answering that question, not when they knew next to nothing about the aliens. Would destroying a fleet carrier cost the aliens 10% of their forces? Or 5%? Or 1%? How many fleet carriers did the aliens have? There was no way to know. And how badly would they be hurt if Alan wiped out a whole convoy? Again, there was no way to know.
"And we're all expendable," Alan thought.
He knew the Admiralty would happily sacrifice the entire flotilla if it killed an alien fleet carrier. But it was impossible to tell how badly that would affect the balance of power. There was a time when the term favorable loss rates became meaningless.
"We might wind up losing the war if the aliens can afford to trade fleet carriers for us."
He stared down at the datapad for a long moment. It had only been a week. Stats would improve, surely. But he knew there were limits. Starfighter piloting was a young man's game, not something for men who were old enough to be fathers. One of them was even a grandfather. There was a reason the military rarely recruited anyone older than 30, and even that was a stretch. But the war took priority. Better to bring back the old fogies than waste younger pilots on what might be a forlorn hope.
"That could be me," he thought as he rose. "I might have been called back to the colors, even if..."
The thought cost him a pang. He'd tried not to think of what his life would have been like if Judith hadn't cheated on him, or if he hadn't killed her. Colchester made it hard to think of what might have been. And yet now, he sighed. Would he have retired? He probably wouldn't have had a shot at a command chair, not when there were plenty of officers with better connections. But he might have gone into training, or wound up flying a desk, or... He cursed himself under his breath. Maybe he would have taken early retirement. Vets got preference almost everywhere. He didn't have the best of educations, but he could have gotten into a training course or even found a job as a consultant. The big corporations liked having military vets on staff. It was easier to sell a starfighter design to the military if it had passed muster with someone who'd actually flown starfighters for a living. He could have watched his daughters grow up. He could have taken them to school, listened to their teachers, threatened their boyfriends.
"They're too young to date," he told himself firmly. "They won't stay that age forever," a little voice pointed out. "And they're not the babies you remember anymore."
He gritted his teeth. The in-laws hadn't been very good about keeping him informed. For all he knew, they were mistreating his daughters. It wasn't impossible. He shook his head angrily. The in-laws might despise him, but they wouldn't harm his little girls. Jeanette and Alice were their daughter's children too. But not knowing was maddening. There hadn't been any response to his letter before the squadron had left Seoul.
"I might have to sue for visitation rights," he thought. "And that won't be easy."
The hatch chimed. He looked up as Maddie stepped into the compartment.
"I have the latest report, sir," she said.
Her uniform looked slightly mussed.
"The new systems performed well."
"In simulations," Alan pointed out.
He took the datapad and read the report quickly.
"We have to remember that simulations are not reality."
"Yes, sir," Maddie said.
Her tone was so painfully polite that he knew she wanted to remind him not to teach his grandmother to suck eggs.
"But they're as close as possible to reality."
"Ha," Alan thought.
He passed the datapad back.
"I'll go through it later," he said. "Right now, I have more simulations to run. Did the Commodore set any time for live fire exercises?"
"No, sir," Maddie said. "But we don't have much time to carry them out."
Alan nodded. The other escort carriers had to be having similar problems then. In peacetime, the thought would have given him a certain amount of guilty amusement. A captain whose ship was at the bottom of the tables for 2 weeks running would be sure to feel the brunt of his admiral's displeasure. And while he knew it was important for everyone to train constantly, it was a relief to know they weren't the worst in the fleet.
"But now we're at war," he thought, "and our very survival may depend on our comrades. I'll check with them later, if we don't have a schedule by the end of the day," he said.
Flying starfighters while they were sneaking through occupied space would be a good way to commit suicide. Starfighters were many things, but they weren't particularly stealthy. The aliens would have plenty of time to note their course and speed, then set an ambush.
"Did you get a report from the sensor crews?"
"They report no major problems," Maddie said. "But they're unsure about alien sensors."
Alan sighed crossly. The aliens had their sensor masks, cloaking devices, one wag had called them. They knew their sensor crews might have to find something else using the sensor masks one day. And they knew enough about the sensor masks to pick out any weaknesses. Tracking a ship in silent running might be easy by comparison. Alan knew better than to assume the aliens weren't looking for ways to break their own stealth. It was what the Royal Navy would have done.
"We might be about to find out," he said.
He rose.
"I need to grab something to eat. Coming?"
Maddie nodded.
"Yes, sir." "Ping Anson,"
Abigail ordered.
"Where is he?"
Poddy, wisely, didn't say a word as she keyed her console. Abigail watched her, reminding herself sharply that whatever had happened wasn't Poddy's fault. But she was damned if she wasn't going to chew Anson out for being late. Freighter crews could be slapdash in places. She didn't care what her crew wore, as long as they did their jobs. But there were limits. Someone who was meant to be on the bridge at 1800 was damn well meant to be on the bridge at 1800. The hatch opened. Anson stepped into the compartment.
"Mum, I..."
Abigail rose.
"Don't you mum me," she snapped. "Where were you?"
She waited, resting her hands on her hips. Her uncle had taught her that being late was unforgivable. There were standards that had to be upheld, whatever the situation. And there had been no emergency that would have distracted Anson from the bridge. She wouldn't have been so angry if she'd thought he had a legitimate reason to be late.
I lost track of time, Anson said.
You mean you were in your bunk with Maddie?
Abigail said. She allowed her voice to tighten.
Didn't you know you were meant to be on duty?
Poddy made a faint sound. Abigail glared. Anson needed a chewing out, but it wasn't something that should be done in public. She glanced at her console, then nodded. Poddy could leave the bridge safely. The sensors would alert them if something required immediate attention.
Poddy, go get something to eat, then have a nap, she ordered. Do not be late for your next shift.
She watched Poddy hurry out the compartment, then switched her gaze back to Anson.
I don't give a good goddamn what you do when you're off duty, she said.
It wasn't entirely true. Anson was her son, after all. But it was a sort of courtesy Belter captains generally offered to their subordinates.
If you want to fuck a grown woman, or a man, or both at once, I don't care.
Anson winced. Abigail spoke over him.
What I cannot tolerate is it interfering with your duties, she added sharply. And I certainly can't tolerate it in my son.
Mum,
Stop mumbling, Abigail snapped. Speak up. If I was Captain Bly, you and Maddie would be floating naked in space with your underpants nailed to your head. Your great uncle would probably have done something